Today's Tesho will be on Case 66 in the Book of Serenity. Case 66 is entitled Zhuihong's Head and Tail. Introduction. Even those who subtly exercise spiritual powers cannot set a foot down. Even those who forget objects and a thought cannot raise a foot. As you might say, sometimes running to death, sometimes sitting to death. How can you attain proper timing? A monk asked Zhuifeng, what is the head? Zhuifeng said, opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn. The monk said, what is the tail? Zhuifeng said, not sitting on a 10,000 year seat. The monk said, how is it when having a head but no tail? Zhuifeng said, after all, it's not precious. The monk said, how about having a tail but no head? Zhuifeng said, though full, no power. The monk said, how about when you get the head and tail in mutual harmony? Zhuifeng said, descendants gain power in the room it's unknown. Verse, round in a compass, square in a ruler, used it acts, left it's concealed, stationary the birds resting on the reeds, going back and forth, the ram caught in the fence, eating others' food, sleeping in one's own bed, clouds spring up and make rain, dew forms and turns to frost. The jade thread is pushed through the eye of the golden needle. Silk floss unceasingly spits from the shuttle's guts. The stone woman's loom stops. The color of night turns toward moon. The wooden man's road turns. The shadows of the moonlight have reached the center. So I want to thank everybody for making such an excellent effort. Many of you got up very early to practice today, and we've done hours of really excellent sitting, really deep, deep samadhi. That's how it's done. That's so important, so wonderful. And thank you for making such an excellent effort. So, you know, if you've been following world events, you probably felt that you really needed to come here and sit. You know, many of us have been following events in the Middle East, and it's really nightmarish and difficult. And it's natural sometimes. When there is so much suffering, and when the possibilities for ending that suffering seem so remote, to just say, you know, I've had enough, I'm going to turn off the radio, turn off NPR, or stop scrolling on the internet, and just I need to protect myself or protect my mind for a while from all of this. And let me say that if you've said that or if you felt that way, I'm not criticizing, right? It's definitely a survival strategy in many cases. Back in the Trump era, one of my good friends told me over lunch once, he said, you know, I was talking about something in the news, and he said, I've just stopped. He said, for my own sanity, I have to stop, right? And he said, I can't control any of this, and I'm just trying to take it day by day, do my job, take care of my kids. And this is somebody I really respect and, you know, really love, really. Somebody I've known for a long time, 20, 30 years maybe, you know, and he was actually a graduate student of mine long ago. So, you know, he works at Rutgers now, you know. So I understood exactly where he was coming from, and I'm glad people are able to create a little space between themselves, a little space between themselves and the events that are unfolding around us. You know, as I say, a necessary, sometimes necessary survival strategy. But all the same, you know, actually, you may be contributing to the problem. And I don't mean that you're not well informed about international events, and that if you're well informed, you'll be able to interpret them better, which is certainly true. But, you know, that desire to recoil from events that are painful and difficult, whether they're happening in the Middle East or they're happening in our own lives, is a necessary survival strategy that may actually contribute to the problem. You know, all of our problems, our biggest problem is that we are able to disconnect from the world around us, you know, and really pretty easily. You know, it's pretty easy to create a kind of invisible sense of separation from the things around us. And we probably do that to defend ourselves, right? That probably is a self-protection mechanism. But, you know, we get really, really good at creating a kind of space between ourselves and everything around us. And I think we do it as we were growing up. I think we learn how to do it maybe very early, maybe even before we acquire language. But we're able to somehow separate ourselves, take ourselves out, imagine ourselves as separate from the things around us. And I mean, we do this, I think, in a million different ways, and we become very adept at this. I know that when I was a kid, I was a very shy kid, and when I would go to school, I was very sensitive to being ridiculed, you know. I had talked my mother into buying me a lunchbox. In the old days, when I was growing up, lunchboxes were made of inexpensive metal, and they usually had a thermos inside, and there was a place for a sandwich and an apple. And they had a little latch on them, and all the lunchboxes that were sold, or many of the lunchboxes that were sold, had TV shows. They were basically advertisements for TV shows. So there was a Leave It to Beaver lunchbox. There were all these shows that were on TV. The company must have made some kind of an agreement with the television show, and they were advertising the show on the lunchbox. And one of the shows I really loved was Walt Disney. This is long before there was a Disney Channel. There was a television show called Zorro about this mysterious masked stranger and who righted wrongs and wore a mask, and it was so set in Mexico. Very cool, I thought. I was living in Baltimore in basically like a apartment house, and nothing was very magical or mysterious where I lived, and I would watch this show and be transported to this other world, you know. And, you know, I was often, where I was living in Baltimore was a fairly tough neighborhood. I've talked about the fact that I often felt like I was in physical danger of getting beaten up, you know, by the older kids, and it was a pretty tough neighborhood. So, you know, this mysterious stranger who no one could catch, and he could defeat everybody in sword fighting, was my idol, right? Here's somebody who's always accomplished and on top of the situation. And, so I had to buy this, I nagged my mother into getting this lunchbox for me, and it was Zorro on his black stallion rearing up, and there was some lightning in the background, and he had his sword and his mask on. And I took this to school, and I was so excited that people would see me with my Zorro lunchbox. And I remember, when the lunch period came, we all helped to spread out these oilcloth tablecloths for lunch. And I went to get my lunchbox, which we stored all our lunchboxes in the coat room. And I came out with my lunchbox, and I was walking towards the table where I was going to sit, and suddenly all the kids were laughing at me. Right. And, I was taken aback, right? I thought, why are they? And I looked behind me, and my thermos had been leaking, and there was a trail of, milk on the floor. And I was so shy, I couldn't laugh at this and say, oh, man, thermoses these days, I felt totally deflated by this incident. And it was like all the magic went out of my plan to be seen with a Zorro lunchbox. And I can remember, just feeling like everything around me was receding, right? Just disappearing. And I was just going into this space where everything was gone, right? And I don't know if you've ever had that experience where you just, it's like maybe if you're highly stressed or you're embarrassed, you get to a point where everything around you just sort of disappears and you're like in a little world by yourself. I think we all can do that sometime to a greater or lesser extent. And, maybe it is self-protection, but we become very, very adroit at being in that place and feeling that sense of separation. It's natural when things are frightening or threatening or we feel helpless that we want to go to that place. You want to turn the radio off, just sit down and be, we could say, with myself, people talk about this as like your happy place. Go to your happy place, or go to your calm place. If your parents used to make you give you a time out and put you on the chair, that was sort of letting you discover there's this, you can create this distance between yourself and the world. And this is a kind of, you could say, defense mechanism that we develop over time. We get pretty good at going to that place when we feel threatened or in danger. And also sometimes, going to that place allows us a little space to be more creative or deal, I can remember when I was taking my doctoral dissertation, one of the people on my committee was famous for being kind of pugnacious. He liked to sort of, poke people in the eye to see what they would do. And I was making this presentation, presenting my research, and he gave me kind of a hard time. And, I sort of went into that place for a little while until I could formulate my response to him, and he seemed moderately happy with what I had to say, but we all get very good at this, and it seems like a saving grace, right, that we can separate ourselves from the world around us, but it actually becomes very hard not to feel separate from the world around us, right? And I think by the time we're adults, that sense of separation is like our default position. And it's destructive, I think, far more destructive than we realize. As I say, it makes sense that we want to retreat into this solitary place when we feel threatened or out of control. But, you know, when we make our home there, it changes how we relate to the world around us, you know? Everything becomes separate from ourselves. And I think by the time we're adults, we're very adept at being in that place. It becomes a kind of comfortable default position. But, you know, actually in practice, it has many destructive consequences, right? Sometimes that wall breaks down, right? If you have a conflict with somebody, you know, like if you're in a romantic relationship or a marriage, or you have a child, you can be in a conflict with that person, and suddenly it feels insoluble, right? It feels like you're never going to be able to work this out, right? It's like you can't reach across that distance to the other person. And when you try, maybe that other person rebuffs you or even, you know, attacks you, you know, in some way. You know, and so, you know, you're sort of stranded in these two solitudes. And then, you know, sometimes something can just break. And you just have this, it's like the wall between you and the other person dissolves. And it might dissolve in tears, and it might dissolve in love, and it might dissolve in pity, you know. But when that happens, it suddenly you realize, oh my God, there's a person on the other end of this. And you begin to feel that person's emotions as though they're your own emotions. Right? And those moments are so precious and hard to achieve sometime, right? It's that sense of distance becomes so much our default position. It becomes difficult sometimes to really connect to other people, you know, and when we connect, it's almost like a miracle, right? It's suddenly that wall goes away, and you feel the other person's emotions as your emotions, or you feel the other person's distress, and it's like your own. You feel that distress as your own distress. And in those moments, I think real compassion, you know, arises. But sometimes it's so hard to get to that place because we've made our bubble, that little safe zone, separate from everything, our default position, or we tend to. Right? And you know, if you look around at all the problems in the world, you know, and this is a big cliche, but when you look at all the problems in the world, so often they're caused by our inability to reach out of our solitude and connect to other people. So if you are looking at what's happening in Gaza, for example, you know, it's horrible to imagine people who would kill other people to make a point, right? And it's horrible to imagine people dying in retaliation, right? That's you know, horrible. And it's natural that we ourselves want to withdraw from all of this because it's so puzzling too. It's like what would be fair in this case, you know, and so how, but on the other hand, you know, it's that sense of separation that creates the problem. And so many of these, you know, this sense of separateness that we develop as we're growing up gets institutionalized in all kinds of ways, right? It's not just us, right? You know, my father was in the military. My family's from New Jersey, but during World War II, my father served in the Navy. He fought in the Pacific. And after he came home from the war, he had a chance to go to college and went to college, and he was a naval officer for a long time. And then eventually he worked for the Department of the Navy, and we were stationed at a military naval installation called Naval Weapons Station in Virginia. We lived on a base, a military base, and we would go into like town the town of Williamsburg, Virginia, to do our grocery shopping. See. And I was just a little kid, but in retrospect, I realize how segregated that town was. I didn't really think about it, right? But you know, the town was, you know, there was like a black grocery store and there was a white grocery store. You know, it just, as I grew up, I began to realize that, you know, I had no friends of color. And also I began to look around, especially when I was in junior high school, and it suddenly dawned on me that there were like these two parks, you know, people, all the black people would be in this park, all the white people would be in this park if they were out of their houses at all. You know, all of this is a symptom of our inability to get outside of our sense, our solitudes, you know, our solitudes. So, you know, we're facing, and the other crisis is, you know, like the environment, right? I mean, if you think about it, you know, the way we treat the natural world as a resource is astonishing, really. You know, many cultures have looked at the natural world as like their body. It's very difficult for them to draw to create a sense of separation between themselves and the natural world, or their own bodies and the natural world. You know, lots of people think of the earth really as quite literally like their mother, right? It's a sentimental cliche for us, but lots of people have like a deeply embodied, intimate relationship with the world around them. They experience the natural, I don't think you have to be a romantic, I think lots of people experience the natural world as inseparable from themselves. But, you know, in our society, we've made the natural world like this thing that's separate from us. So many of our problems are function of this. And it's interesting to me that, you know, as things like Buddhism have come to the Western world, you know, we're in a moment where we may allow our world, our culture, and our ways of thinking to be changed by Buddhism. But also we may change Buddhism and make it fit our ways of thinking and living. And I think if that happens, it would be a really big missed opportunity, right? Because I don't think our way of life is particularly healthy or enlightened. So I would love it if we could be a little bit changed by Buddhism. But I worry that that's not happening because we're making Buddhism fit into our familiar ways of thinking and acting. You know, so we understand the mind as something that is in our heads or in that. Really, we think of the mind as being in that little space of our solitude, right? So you have your mind, and I have my mind, and my mind is in that little space of solitude, and your mind is in your little space of solitude. And, you know, this is a big dilemma for people in the West, right? It's like, how can I ever know what's going on in your head? Because I can't peer into your space of solitude. And you know, meditation, I think, has it becomes sort of Americanized, you know, it's sort of fitting into this, where, people practice meditation in order to control their minds. You see, so people say, I'm trying to control my mind, or they'll say, my mind is agitated, and I want to quiet my mind. Right? So this is, I started meditating thinking that way myself. Like, my mind is agitated, or my mind is stressed. I need to de-stress my mind. Right? And so, you know, when we sit on the cushion, what we're doing is we're de-stressing the mind. We're purifying the mind. And mindfulness, I think, often is sort of fits with that paradigm, right? Where, you know, the mind is agitated and we make it calm, or the mind is angry and we make it less angry, or the mind is frightened and we make it, you know, we put it to rest, right? But actually, you know, that's really not Buddhist teaching, right? There's no such thing as an agitated mind. There's no such thing as an agitated mind. There's no such thing as a fearful mind, or there's no such thing as a traumatized mind. None of those things are really mind. Those are all the ways we imagine mind. Those are all ways we imagine the mind. And when we imagine the mind that way, it actually deepens our sense of isolation and solitude. See, I don't know if this is making any sense this morning, but I think I'm onto something, right? In other words, you know, there's a famous story that goes like this. It's not this koan, but it's another koan. Bodhidharma was the Indian monk who brought Zen from Zen to China. And Bodhidharma was living in a cave near what is now the Shaolin Temple. And he was just waiting for people, the students, to show up. And believe it or not, somebody showed up. So in Japanese, he's known as Shinko. And Shinko was like intellectual, very well educated, and he had exhausted Confucian study and Taoist study, and he couldn't free himself from his emotional and mental distress. And he finally heard about this crazy Indian monk living in this cave. And he went up to the cave. He was so desperate, right? You know, he tried everything, you know. And he was so desperate, he actually found this monk living in this cave. Famously, he says to Bodhidharma, he says, you know, my mind is on fire. You know, I'm so unhappy. My mind is in torment. You know, can you set me free? And Bodhidharma says, oh, show me your mind. And Shinko, sitting there, you know, on the ground, tries to find his mind. And he can't find his mind. You know, it's nowhere to be found, right, as we say. And when he suddenly realizes this, it's like, it's absolutely, he's sort of thunderstruck. And he turns to Bodhidharma and he says, I can't find my mind. And Bodhidharma says, see, now I've set you free. You know? So, you know, when we say my mind is agitated, that's not your mind. That's the way you imagine yourself as agitated. Or when you say, my mind is, you know, whatever, your mind has no characteristics whatsoever. We can when we imagine the mind, when we say, I'm going to calm my mind now by sitting on the cushion, we're not calming the mind. We're not. That's what we say, but it's not what's happening. Sometimes I say, we're going to purify the mind, but we're not purifying the mind. See, that's really a useful fiction. The mind has no, these are all things that the mind imagines, but the mind itself is formless. It has no boundaries. It has no limits and no boundaries. It's always already luminous and pure. When we imagine ourselves as striving to calm our minds or clean our minds or cure our minds, we're actually reinstating that sense of separateness from the world around us. And by the way, you can experience this yourself, the truth of what I'm saying yourself. You know, many people, when they begin to meditate, when they begin to meditate, they notice that their quote-unquote mind is becoming more calm. So maybe you're an inveterate worrier, as I was, and maybe still am sometimes at 3 a.m. in the morning. You know, and you worry and you worry, and then, you know, basically you sit down on the cushion and your mind goes blank. And you can say, you know, I'm calmer now. But as I say, you know, that's actually not what's happening, right? You're imagining yourself as fearful, or you're imagining your mind as frightened. But the mind itself has no qualities. And if you practice meditation for a while, you will feel as though, you know, your thoughts begin to become fewer and farther between. Your mind begins to be empty, right? And you can be sitting there thinking, you know, I've really purified my mind. I'm really there. I'm really doing it. And then, you know, maybe your kid comes in the room, or somebody knocks on the door, and you find yourself getting really angry. You think, God damn it, you know, you're interrupting my beautiful peace of mind. So notice what you've done. You know, this is something I worry about. You know, notice that what we've done is we've created something called pacifying the mind, or calming the mind. And when we calm the mind and pacify the mind, we turn it into something else that separates us from the world around us. So now, when somebody knocks on the door and they disturb our, quote, peace of mind, our beautiful, calm peace of mind, we're mad at them, right? Like, God damn it, how dare you interrupt my Buddha-like samadhi, right? So what that shows us is that we've misunderstood the path, right? Now, when you are in deep samadhi, you know, basically you enter this at some point, maybe today in our sitting, right? You reached a point that was, you know, where the mind is really empty, and you're not even aware of your mind. There's just this, you could say, this bright emptiness. And this bright emptiness, in this bright emptiness, there's really no self-referencing going on at all, right? And if we stay in that state long enough, you know, we begin to realize that, you know, it has it doesn't disappear when we turn our attention to the things around us. You know, so initially it's very hard to get into that state, right? And if somebody does interrupt us, we feel it slipping away, or it just breaks and it's gone, right? And it's like, damn. But if you keep practicing meditation, you know, you enter that thoughtless state to some degree if you practice regularly. And, you know, we call that state samadhi. You know, the Pali Sutras call it bright mind. It's like the Buddha said, it's like he pointed to a piece of cloth that was just like white cloth. When you're in deep samadhi and you enter empty mind, right? We say, sometimes we say mushin, blank mind, dark mind. And you know, you begin to experience the world around you, you know. Everything can feel like your own body. Everything can feel like your own self. And this is like a momentous, this is like so important, right? From the Buddhist standpoint, this is actually much closer to reality than what we call reality. You know, we people think that you're in reality most when many people think that reality is the world as when we perceive it as completely separate from ourselves. Reality is really most real when the world is completely separate from ourselves. And we have those moments when we do feel like the hardness of the world around us and the separateness of the world around us. We do have moments where that's very clear. You know, it's like everything just seems to be very much an object separate from ourselves around us. And when we're in that state, we may think, now this is reality, see. That's very common for people to feel that way. Meaning, you know, it's this way whether you like it or not. It's this way whether you're there or not. But, you know, that's actually a highly artificial and unenlightened state, according to Buddhism. You know, when we are in that state, people can seem very separate also, and they can, you know, seem menacing, or that we may regard them as things we can manipulate to our advantage, right? So I often think that Mr. Trump, you know, is always in that state of mind where he's just trying to manipulate people because he thinks of them as separate from himself, see? But when we meditate, initially we get into this state where the mind begins to empty out and we feel like we're grounded in something, we're in samadhi. And, everybody experiences samadhi a little differently, but I often experience samadhi like I can feel myself on the cushion like after about an hour of sitting, or sometimes less. You know, I feel like I'm going into something. It's like diving into a pool. I don't know if you've ever done this, but if you dive into the diving side of a pool and you go down like 12 feet, this water pressure is very strong, right? It's like you're suddenly in that water and it's exerting its pressure on you. So to me, samadhi kind of feels like that. And I think it's kind of accurate. I think what I'm feeling is the world around me, you know, actually. Everything around me is now right here, right here. But when we go into samadhi, we begin to experience, we become thoughtless, and we begin to experience, I think, our connectedness to everything around us. And, you know, we start interacting with the world very differently. If you have been meditating and you, at Sesshin, you know, we'll meditate for like 3 hours. Then we have a break and people go and walk around and look at the flowers and look at the trees. And when you're in that state, you know, you feel so deeply connected. Everything around you, so you look at the flower and it's like, where do I stop and where does the flower start? Where does that me stop and the flower start? Because it's impossible to say. And this is not a trance state or like a high, right? It's not like, this is, from the Buddhist standpoint, this is actually reality. You know, this is what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing. So interbeing is reality. Separateness is the fantasy. So when we meditate, you know, it's probably the case that we start out meditating because we are so deeply trapped in this illusion of our separateness that we experience the things around us as causes for distress and so on. And I fear that, you know, in America, mindfulness is being marketed as like a technology for controlling your mind, right? For improving your mental state and so on. And what we do when we meditate is we begin to dissolve that boundary between ourself and the world, and it becomes impossible to say where your mind starts and anybody else's mind stops. It's like interbeing, intermind. Intermind. Yeah. So this is a koan really about all of this that I've just been talking about. I finally get to the koan. But a monk asks Zhuifeng, what is the head? See, what is the head? He's talking about, he uses a metaphor here, head and tail. He says, what's the head? And Zhuifeng says, open in the eyes and not being aware of the dawn. And I think what he's talking about is, in the initial state of our meditation practice, we have to get to a place where we feel very separate from everything. It's almost like we first have to go to that safe space, that safe empty space. And then, you know, we begin to move out into the world again in a different state of consciousness. Like in our samadhi mind, we leave our separate place and we reach out into the world, and now we experience it in a different way. You know, all, you could think of all Zen practice as, Buddhism says that we have misunderstood reality in whole and in part, in profound ways. And so what meditation practice does is it takes us back to zero. It takes us back to like point zero of awareness, emptiness. And now when we can enter samadhi, we can rebuild our image of the world, our experience of the world, but not in a mistaken way, in an integrated way. So, you know, the ordinary picture of the world is very based on our sense of separateness. And all of our relationships with others, all it is based on, one might say, a certain sense of separateness. And you know, Buddhism meditation practice takes you back to ground zero. And then, you know, you discover this samadhi power, consciousness of interbeing, And once you're in that consciousness and you begin to experience the world around you, you begin to experience it as your own body, And, you know, it's not as though you go to Sesshin one day and you have this experience and forever after you're changed. But what happens is that we have these moments where everything is experienced as ourself, as our body. And then, you know, you snap back into your usual, sort of our usual alienated state, but maybe a little less completely. And then you come to a Saturday sit and you do it again, or you come to a sesshin and you do it again. And little by little, that very rigid wall between yourself and the world disappears, and you begin to spend more and more of your time experiencing that interbeing state. And, you know, in that state, you know, you're very receptive to other people and to their needs and their suffering and their happiness and so on. It's definitely a superior state. So the head is being able to go into that deep samadhi state, to dive into the bottom of the pool, and, you know, you experience your interconnectedness, right? And then you start experiencing the world around you in this fundamentally different way. A metaphor that Buddhists often use for this is pure land. Pure land. You may have heard of pure land Buddhism, and, you know, people don't, in the West, don't generally practice pure land Buddhism very much. So they don't know what it means. But, you know, when you experience things around you as separate from yourself, that's really samsara. That's samsara. That's the world of suffering. Whether you're happy or not, at that moment, when you experience things as separate from yourself, you're really in a state of samsara. But when we are able to go deeply into our samadhi mind and experience everything as like part of ourselves, This is like purifying the world. This is like purifying the world. So every time we do this, we're purifying our world, but we're also purifying everybody's world. So this is like bodhisattva work. When you purify, when you free yourself from your sense of separation and you realize that the mind has no boundaries, no boundaries are seen, as we say in the Shinshin Ming. There's nothing is not within your mind, right? Nothing is not separate from your mind or from mind. Right? We're transforming not only our own lives, but we're transforming the whole world around us, sort of like one moment at a time. So every time you come to the Saturday sit and you meditate, you're creating the pure land. That's a world where everything is alive, everything is in awakened consciousness, is recognized as part of awakened consciousness. So the awakened consciousness is the head, and the world that you encounter on and off the cushion is the tail, right? And what he's saying is that our task in life, you know, we start out feeling separate. If we didn't, we wouldn't practice Zen. Is gradually this process of emptying out, going into samadhi, and then experiencing the world as part of ourselves. Right? This is like a process. And this is the fundamental practice of the Dharma. The monk said at the end, how about when you get head and tail in mutual harmony? Right? And Zhuifeng said, then descendants gain power. It's in the room, it's unknown. It's like in that state, all distinctions disappear. You know, and everything, caring for the world is like caring for yourself. Caring for the world is caring for yourself. Caring for yourself is caring for the world. A monk asked Zhuifeng, what is the head? Zhuifeng said, opening the eyes and not being aware of the dawn. The monk said, what is the tail? Zhuifeng said, not sitting on a 10,000-year seat. The monk said, how is it when having a head but no tail? Zhuifeng said, after all, it's not precious. The monk said, how about having a tail but no head? Zhuifeng said, though full, no power. The monk said, how about when you get head and tail in mutual harmony? See? And Zhuifeng said, descendants gain power in the room, it's unknown. Verse. Round in a compass, square in a ruler. So the mind is formless, right? When the mind is round in a compass and it's square in a ruler, but it has no characteristics of its own. Round in a compass, square in a ruler, used it acts, left it's concealed. Stationary, the birds resting on the reeds, going back and forth, the ram caught in the fence, eating others' food, sleeping in one's bed. Clouds spring up and make rain, dew forms and turns into frost. The jade thread is pushed through the eye of the golden needle, silk floss unceasingly spits from the shuttle's guts. The stone woman's loom stops. The color of night turns toward noon. The wooden man's road turns. The shadow of the moonlight have reached the center. See, even a stone woman and a wooden man come to life when we're in this awakened mind. So thank you so much for spending some time at the bottom of the pool today. Let's keep going there together.